Welcome to Living in the Matrix. I'm Jonathan, and I'm left of center.
And I'm Rich, and I tend to lean a little bit more to the right. But the bottom line is together we try to look for the balance of what it means to be human in today's world.
Well, let's get started, everyone. Welcome to Living in the Matrix. I'm Jonathan, and this is my co-host, Rich. Say hello, Rich.
Howdy, folks. Hope everybody's having a great day and looking forward to a great weekend. Looking forward to getting back together one-on-one with my good buddy, Jonathan. Let's go.
Yes. So today we had kind of an interesting, we had no guests scheduled, and Rich and I talked about an idea of kind of current topics around the matrix in life and really that is relevant to this podcast. So what we wanted to do was have sort of a discussion on a couple videos that we found. So here's the first video.
I'm not right. I'm not left. I'm not Republican. I'm not Democrat. I'm not libertarian. I'm a human f-ing being that wants the best for the rest of the human beings. And I want some common f-ing sense. And I want to be left alone. I want to pay low taxes. I want to be able to go build things and prosper and get all the things that have been promised to me in the constitution of this country. That's what I want. And until people wake the f-ing up and stop identifying with left or right, Republican, Democrat, black, white, gay, straight, all the shit. Until we figure that out and stop doing that, we will continue to be abused by these people who hold the power.
What'd you think?
Yeah, I think what the guy is saying.
What's the first thing that stands out to you?
Well, I don't know where he really leans. Everybody leans one way. We all have lenses, right? Now, perspectives. But I like where he's coming from because he's starting to bring clarity to the idea that there are factors, it appears to be, that are driving divisions, right? There are, maybe it's beneficial that we remain divided. We all know that when we're in a high cortisol level state, that we're suspect of two different levels when there's a fear of things happening, right? Whether it's immigration in the southern border, whether it's a new coronavirus or something affecting mosquitoes or Ebola found in some person, you know, a hantavirus. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that, the mainstream media seems to perpetuate this stuff, right? And we've got our Fox News that has it on right of center and our others that right. are left of center. So I think what he's done is he's identified the fact that, you know, at the end of the day, if we could all look at ourselves in the mirror, we would all want to prosper. We would all want to say, yeah, I don't want to kill anybody. I don't want to cause problems. I might debate somebody, but if I could live my own life peacefully and work hard and not have a shit ton of money taken out in taxes, I'd want the best. If everybody gets that same benefit, then everybody wins, right? And so how do we separate, you know, all of the bullshit that's being foisted upon us and come to that same agreement on certain things? The biggest challenge to this, again, is you have to live on a farm, you know, that doesn't have any outside access to avoid all of the division because you're going to be exposed to it no matter where you go. So how did we come up with that solution of what he's talking about?
Well, the thing that really got me about what he said was common sense. That's the first thing that really grabbed me. Well, his opening of I'm not left or right, because
yes,
I don't like the idea of being left or right, that I need to define myself. I have to separate myself from you. I don't like that idea. I like the us first, the we, like Sean talks about. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of value, but I'm also recognizing that the we doesn't exclude the I. The I exists. This avatar exists. And I think both together, it's always a both and. Like going back to David Artman, it's a both and approach. Love, mm-hmm. The kingdom is ultimately both. And it learning
grace to, extends to all and grace alone saves. Me.
Meeting in the middle. That's this place is where love exists. And I think that's mm-hmm. the thing that I'm throughout this entire process of doing this podcast, I've realized we've explored ideas in people's lives that are around polarities. And it's the polarity that is where all the emotion is. And I keep coming back to Brittany and that middle point of how do the poles come and meet in the middle and recognize the validity of both sides. And I think that's what there's a passion in what he said around common sense. Like you look at Washington and it's just, this is arguably politically the worst time in my life. And I was around for Nixon, Reagan getting shot, all the impeachment shit. This is the most concerned I've ever been for our country, ever. And I think that's the common sense that he's talking about that's missing. So,
well, let me ask you this. I agree with you. And I think we all know that every generation thinks the Antichrist is around the corner and there's plagues and pestilence and the shit that's in the fed. I mean, imagine the United States in the early 1900s with the Spanish influenza that killed 15 to 20 million people across the globe. That was terrifying, right? And in World War I and World War II. But even then, what we have now is something that seems to be so overarching. It affects everything about us, our psyche, our livelihoods, our future generations, our planet. And one of the things that's starting to really scare me is that the United States government, you know, is not the big philanthropist that we've flouted ourselves to be, right? I mean, it doesn't take a lot of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was on with an MSNBC host, and he basically just said, we blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. We did it. Duh. Right. And you're seeing with Tucker, and, you know, we've basically admitted that, yes, the CIA was involved in the assassination of JFK. Like back in the 60s, of course, we were always a little confused about it. And even Oliver Stone thought there was something funny with a magic bullet. Like, how does this bullet go six times through the whole body? So here's the thing.
Right.
The other reason why it's scary is because you're realizing that there is no left to right. There's only power. That, that Mitch McConnell's of the world are not the good guys, right? The right wing, the Republicans aren't necessarily the good guys. The Democrats aren't necessarily the bad guys, or vice versa.
We have the Clinton family and the progressive side. I mean, it's like the cabal of power. It's wild that politically, here's what's. I always look for what's going to be the black swan that can change a culture. You know, like Me Too was a black swan type of idea where things change rapidly and quick in an age of social media.
In a good way, though.
Absolutely in a good way.
Harvey Weinstein was taken down for years of predatory behavior. That was a good black swan. But when you've got Klaus Schwab saying there's going to be a black swan event and the World Economic Forum is talking about a black swan event, that's the wrong kind of black swan event. That's the kind of
pandemic. No, I agree.
Black swan, yeah. But
I also think that the black swan could come out of nowhere, because here's the reality. If you really boil the 1% down to anything, it's they're not part of the majority. The power of any culture and society is the capacity to gather together collectively enough with love that it can overwhelm the corruption. And that's people standing up and saying, I am, like, something needs to dramatically change to create, like Buckminster Fuller said, the only way to change something wrong is to create something new. And I think that's what he's talking about in that video, is we need something new. And I think that is that's something does not look like what we have. We can keep our structural system of Congress and senators and presidents. I think that works, but we've got to really look at what are the levers that are corrupting that. And it is ultimately the corporation and its capacity to own the media. And basically all, you know, that's the nature of social media now, is that it's not totally under control of all of that, even though they own it. They just make money off it. But what happens in those streams is all. So it's, I think we need something new that fundamentally changes our way of life in a positive way. And I think that's the arc of this whole last 4 years of greed is good capitalism, is it reaching a point where the cat's out of the bag? Like, Kennedy was shot by our government. You know, it's like those are the kind of things that when the cat comes out of the bag and then UFOs show up, is anybody shocked anymore by our own corruption? Because I think we can see that the system is corrupted on both sides, Trump and Biden. They're both part of the corruption and the system that is controlled by money. So
one of the things I was going to ask you, though, is about the love thing. So one of the things that I'm hoping that takes place is that there is this divine, this movement that tries to actually effectively change our consciousness. I think the call it God, Mm-hmm. Jesus, the universe in its way of trying to craft and help us.
Yes.
Something transcendent needs to happen because we're not going to wake up and have that sense of love. The thing that I'm recounting is the people that when they have their first child, they see something new, as Buckminster Fuller said. They've got something new and they've got something to fight for and they've got a purpose. And they start to know, even through a tough like childbirth and all this stuff, they start to learn what love could really be in a real tangible way. They didn't have that sense. They had maybe loved their wife, but now they've got something new. And sometimes I'm going to give you an interesting example because the whole we talked about DEI before, which tends to divide people, right? You got, oh my God, these people are trying to do reparations right. And they're bringing in people. We're going to get killed because we've got a pilot who was routed through the system and the person doesn't know how to fly a plane, but they did it for DEI sake and somebody's going to die. Right. So that's on this side. And then on this side, it's like, no, going back to the old discriminatory days of we're white patriarchy. Now, what was interesting is I was talking to a gal today who is a professor at ASU. And she's also a coach there. And she was saying that somebody in this diversity class that she was in was like, well, you're privileged. So how can you come? She goes, honey, you don't know anything about me. I was the poorest person. I wore my brother's jeans, right? So here's a gal who's in academia who wasn't given a silver spoon. And one of the things I thought of was like, how do we come up with creative ways to bring people together that actually educates and creates empathy or at least the other? So yes. me and my wife were celebrating with that bonus that she got. And we were at a cafe in Ojai called Tres Hermanas. And I thought, hey, is this called Tres Hermanas because it's based on the three sisters running the place? She goes, no, it's about three agricultural things for the indigenous people, how squash and beans and corn all grow together almost in a divine symbiotic way that helps sustain a culture. I'm like, damn, that's so cool. That's the three sisters. And right. I'm thinking that's something new that I liked. It creates a sense of curiosity. I learned something new and an other that brings together and it brought me that. And so how do we create a paradigm where outside of having a new relationship or having some kind of extant thing bring you into a situation where you're almost brought into the kind of love, how do you foster ideas that begin with curiosity and shared common interests so that we do get to that point, right? Because we could be beating our heads all day long if we don't have a good formula.
Well, I think I would go back to Paulo Freire here. So Paulo Freire wrote
Pedagogy of the
Oppressed. Yeah. And for our listeners who don't know, because it's a esoteric work, but it's brilliant. He studied how people come out of oppression. And I think he was the Chilean minister of finance or something like that. I can't remember.
I think he was Brazilian.
Or Brazilian, yeah. But the point is that in order for change to happen, the oppressor will never voluntarily give up its power, ever. That's just not the way the oppressor will work because they believe that if they let go of that oppression, the masses are going to kill them. So they'll never let it go because they rule by fist and power. And what he said is the only way to get the majority to see their oppression is to establish their dignity. You have to teach people of their own dignity and value so they will learn that they are valuable enough to fight for.
Ontologically.
So you have to have a meaningful reason to participate in your own restoration or removal from oppression. And I think that's what's missing is first the story of the collective here, because what is happening is the polarities. You're either left or right, black or white, gay or straight. And what does that look like at Brittany's center point in the middle between all of those polarities? What's the center? That's love. And I think what's missing is, hey, you and I are neighbors. You want to agree not to harm each other? Like simple agreements like that to say, listen, let's just agree to trust each other. And how big does that trust circle exist? Like what if we could establish simple ways of establishing trust between people so you know that it's there? And that's the fabric. Digitally, you could do that. And the so it's from there, all of these creative ideas can happen because people learn to trust each other. That's my point, is I think we are at a state where we need a structure of trust, because that's what our parents had. Our parents had, remember when we were kids, you didn't worry about your neighbors. You know, it's like a lot of people.
You left your bikes in the driveway. You left the bikes in the driveway, yeah, right? All kinds of stuff.
You assume the best of your neighbor, not the worst. They weren't, you know, yeah, we had racism. Okay, that's the one we had in spades. But the polarity was dominated by the white party. So it wasn't even like they were in control. Going back to Paulo Freire, the question is, how do we rise up in awareness of our dignity so that we will fight for ourselves? I think that's the first question we have to answer, is like, look at the founding fathers of this country. What made them say, hey, screw you, Europe, you know, England, we're going to, this is our land now, and to fight for that?
Because there was a lot of oppression. Obviously, there was, it felt like they didn't have autonomy.
I'll give you oppression. Okay. I was in San Jose yesterday, and I picked up the Mercury News, and homelessness in San Jose has doubled in the last 2 years. Okay. Doubled. I'm sorry, not in San Jose, in the Bay Area. So the whole peninsula and the horseshoe.
Actually, yeah.
It's doubled because of the cost of living. Like a house in San Jose, a 3-2 is 1.5 million. Think about that. The logic of that, you know?
Bought for $87,000, you know, 25 years ago or 30 years ago, right?
Well, yeah, 30 years. So when I bought my dad's condo for, I sold my dad's condo for $140,000 back then. It's now worth $1.4 million. So we were talking about that. It's like life is out of balance right now. That's the problem. Life is out of, I don't want to take anybody's billions away. I don't want to do that. I want a better way so we don't need people to be billionaires. That's my wonder of how we create that. How do we create a world that doesn't need billionaires? Like, let's use AI for that.
Well, you've got an absolutely excellent case where, you know, you can talk about politics, but you can, let's talk about our Gen Zs, our millennials, these poor kids are working their asses off. Their degree, they're saddled with debt. They don't. I mean, you watch these poor girls get on TikTok and talk about, I've got a job, but I can't even go out this weekend. I could barely even feed myself, right? And it takes away hope. And that this is a huge thing. There's tens of thousands, if not millions, of people out there that are in this particular position. And if you don't have family that you can hook up with and create new paradigms. I mean, my sister's going to move to northeast of Spokane with her old husband. They're going to get back together and develop 20 acres out there in northeast Washington state, like 100 miles away from Canada and, you know, 30 minutes away, 40 minutes away from Idaho. Maybe that's what it looks like. And maybe that's where community comes from, to try to get back to grassroots. And maybe that's where farming and getting back to the basics happen. But because how else could you insert something that's going to change that? You know, I mean, Trump's going to try to drain the swamp and get things back to where they were prior to Biden coming into the office, right? Which people were relatively happy. We had energy independence. Homelessness was bad, but it wasn't as bad. I mean, it's literally gotten so bad. And it's partially because of inflation. Yeah. But we've got a border where you've got millions of people. Now people are starting to get killed, and finally people are having vigils about it. I mean, people are getting raped and killed every freaking day all across this country by people who don't give a fuck. And that's, I don't know how you start to make an impact on that without some kind of external presence saying, hey guys, it's all going to be okay and we're going to fix this. And even Trump, God bless him, can't come in and make it all go away. I mean, what can he do in that regard? I mean, dude, Biden literally said on a press conference today, he's in Texas, in Brownsville. He's in the non-painful part. So he's got these optics of, hey, everything's fine here. We only had 12 immigrants come across over the last few days, whereas Trump is in Eagle Pass, where thousands of them come across all the time. But he literally just said, all these houses are getting burnt up except for the ones with the right roofs. Now, you know where that comes from. There's a conspiracy in Maui where all of these, and in Chile.
Oh, yeah, the blue roofs.
If your roofs are blue, like Oprah's, like Zuckerberg's, like all these other people, then you don't get torched by the DEWs or whatever it is. So he literally lets that escape because his mind isn't there. And, you know, so what the heck do you do when you see somebody say that, they're right in front of you on in front of television. I mean, I just saw it blow up all over Twitter because somebody says, was this edited? No, he literally just said that. What the hell does that mean? And that's where I think that adds to the confusion, because you've got a presidential address, you know, and you think you should be able to rely on that, you know?
Yeah.
And so anyway.
Did you see Mitch McConnell's breakdown? God.
Oh, I've seen him. Like, he's frozen. Catatonic. I mean, he's literally. Yeah.
Like he was mortal.
Oh, God.
Completely. That was a dementia type moment. 100%. I don't know if it was dementia, but it was like he just had he had nothing in that moment. You could see it in his eyes.
If not catatonic. Yeah, he was standing. He didn't collapse like a bunch of broccoli. But yeah, he's done. He stepped down, right? But I don't know if you know this. His sister-in-law.
No, he's not stepping down until September.
Oh, God. As the leader?
Because he wants to go through all the election cycles shit.
Oh, God. Please. Yeah. No. Yeah. But his sister-in-law was just killed.
Oh, really?
Supposedly it was a car crash where her car landed into a river and it was like an accident. And they're like, no, I don't think that was an accident. There's something going on, dude. That's where we're living in the Matrix, where this conspiracy shit comes in. And
all right, let's go to number two.
We got to move on. I know.
Yeah, no, this was a good conversation. I like this because it was, you know, we both got to share some thoughts about it. So I like it. All right. Which one did you want to do next? You pick one.
We could do the ice bath one. Let's do the funny one. Yeah, it's okay. A little more practical. We could talk about some science behind it too, you know.
Okay. I lost my penis in an ice bath. Or 15 minutes I had no shaft. I lost my pecker in a cold plunge. I had two balls, now I have none. Misplaced my willy in a cold, cold pool. Got 10 bags of ice trying to act so cool. Now I'm playing with Molly with my doodly doodly doo. But I don't care because my body is recovering faster than you. Ice bath, ice bath. Hands up if you got an ice bath. No chaff in an ice bath. A couple of boys living in an ice bath. Ice bath, ice bath. Hands up if you got an ice bath. No chaff in an ice bath. So what'd you think? That was creative. I have to give that guy like supreme props for creativity. I thought that was I was brilliant. What'd you think?
Yeah, a lot of different ways to say that hopping in an ice bath is bad for your pecker and your gonads. So here's the thing. Let's talk about where the origin of these ice baths started, and then we can talk about how it recently got more and more popular. So there's a guy named Wim Hof, who is this guy from the Netherlands. He's a Dutchman, and he's always exposed to this cold stuff because it's freezing out there. And what he started doing was these combinations of ice plunges and just cold exposure, as well as deep breath work to help, you know, get your body and mind in this amazing state. And, you know, over the course of time, you can watch him just become more and more flexible and have this energy and almost this craziness. And then as you start to pile up the YouTube videos, you watch people who have been bedridden with some types of inflexibility, some kinds of disease, other types of problems, where after they start doing these cold plunges, they start getting better physiologically, more flexibility, less inflammation, more of a will to life, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that was like years ago. I mean, he's been doing this for years, but more recently with the introduction of, I mean, athletes have always had ice baths right when they're done with their stuff. So traditionally, if you're in a sports room, like if all these guys at the NFL, they're going to have a really rough day out there and they're going to come off the field and they're going to hop in that ice bath, mm-hmm. which helps that kind of beat up body, right? Their bodies get beat up all the time and it helps kind of restore that. Now, the whole idea of believe it or not, though, with the cold plunge is like, no, you want to do it first thing in the morning because that's what activates all of the good properties. And we've seen things like with Dr. Brekka talk about three or four things that happen when this happens physiologically. Number one is it introduces cold shock proteins to the body. The liver mm-hmm. sees that immediate danger and introduces these proteins, which help, you know, get your dopamine, mitochondria, and other levels, which also mitochondria spins up in firing up the powerhouse of the cell through the brown fat activation. So brown fat gets activated as well. On top of all that, he was saying that you know, if you look at it physiologically, doing like 5 minutes of an ice bath is the equivalent of doing like hours of high intensity workout in terms of actually shredding fats and in terms of doing things like putting your body into a state immediately of having done exercise. And then other people like even look at it like, hey, if you do this in the morning, it's the hardest thing you're going to have to do all day. It's going to help you get through the day. So there's so many levels of that, right? But now you're starting to see the repercussions and the pushback. And some of these people, like, you do know that your body thinks it's dying, right? When you jump into a frozen lake or if you're like ice fishing and you fall in, your body is going to go into full-blown fight mode. Let's talk about the cortisol spiking, the adrenaline, all that type of thing that goes through your body. Why would you want to do that to yourself, right? For a 20-minute dopamine rush or an hour-long dopamine rush that you get as you come out of that whole process. So I think really what it comes down to is another one of these kinds of scenarios where we're in a world where we're exposed to all these kinds of things. Oh, you're having a rough life? It's your gut biome. Here's 80 million different products that you can produce. This tablet, this pill, this probiotic, this kind of diet to help with your gut biome. And then you realize that some of this is absolute bullshit. You don't even know what's happening. So to answer your question in short, because I do ice baths, right? I was in one yesterday and it was 36 degrees. And I will tell you, it was fucking amazing. I was coming off of, you know, a little bit of a bender and I just hopped in there and dude, it was magnificent. I didn't even breathe. Like once you've done it, you get it. You've got the muscle memory and
you can do it. So it's just a matter of doing it. Yeah.
But I normally am in the 40s and sometimes I'll settle for low 50s, but 36 is a big difference between 36 degrees. Dude. Yeah. It's a big difference between 36 and 48. You know,
there is. Yes. Well, you gotta, that's new level of memory. It is. Yeah, you're reaching a new level. Cause here's the thing is I think the pros of ice bath infinitely outweigh the cons because to the first point, you're putting your body into a state where it thinks it's dying is the biohack. You're using that state to your advantage by teaching yourself to do hard things. And the hardest part about life is that we don't know what we can do until we're in the moment we're required to do it. And in that moment, sometimes we can't do it. So we reach a limit. And ice baths are a mental process of challenging yourself and saying, okay, can I get in the fucking water at when it's 36 degrees, you know? And you're teaching yourself resilience through that process to discover you can, because you haven't died yet. In other words, the potential for death is so ridiculously small, and the value benefits physiologically, mentally, and to the next point is when you start valuing yourself and seeing what you can do, that inspires confidence and courage. And you can start doing new things because you learn, oh, most of my limitations are things that I've created for myself where I said I can't. Well, the value of being our age is we can call bullshit on ourselves and say, oh, well, wait a minute. I learned when I was 6, I couldn't, but maybe when I'm 56, I can. And that's the value. And it takes 8 minutes a day. And the value of it is like we drink coffee and the value of coffee lasts 15 minutes. That's all it lasts on your body because it simulates the same idea of the cold shock protein. The value of the ice bath lasts 2 to 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So there's infinite value to this process. I think, back to the video quickly, it's creative that it got to that level of culture that they're now doing satire on it. Cause it's really funny. I thought it's integrated itself into society as a norm now.
That's true. That's a good point. And to add to that is that, what I was going to say is in terms of the benefit, I think people who really do it consistently, it's the same kind of thing as having a good diet and keeping that intermittent fast. It's the same thing as meditating. And it's the same thing as, as the ice plunge and the exercise. When you maintain these regimens and you do them again and again and again, it builds that process in you, right? And yes. Like success begets success, right? And so I think when you overcome these things, it probably could even help with addiction. It could help with relationships, et cetera. One of the things that our other guest, Nate Taylor, said from Keyspan is, you know, when you've got a community that gets together, and so he's trying to build this health care community with HealthSpan and a community of not only people with good ideas for diet, fasting, you know, blood work and taking some supplements, but they also get together and they do cold plunges, right? And when you have that shared community of a potential situation that is very challenging, right? When I went my 5 days, we were seven of us in this fast. Brutal. There was parts of it where we're like dying, right? We're sick of the freaking lame soup, or we're sick of, you know, this little cracker or this weird propylene glycol water we're drinking to do stuff. But at the same time, when you can build a community that kind of shares and kind of almost a shared misery, but a shared challenge that you overcome, kind of like you see running groups. I mean, I watched, we were walking downtown Ventura, and they were me and Hunter were walking downtown, and we saw this, we did a 4 mile walk ourselves, but they were just finishing up a marathon. And what was amazing about this marathon wasn't just the fact that people were running a marathon. These people were all coming in now. It was like 5.5 hours. So they were the laggards, right? You want to do a marathon to qualify for Boston. It's 3:15, 3:30. I did my only marathon on 4:25, and I only trained 4 months or 2 months for it. So I didn't do that good, but these cats were coming in at 6 hours, and yet the family was still coming around them. So what this was doing was all these people were gathered by family, and to think that this person who dedicated, you know, 6 months of training and beat up their body for 26 miles, which less than 2% of the population's ever done, that brought community together too, right? And so this is a support network, and people talk about when they go through these things. I wouldn't have been able to do it without my wife, who took care of the, you know, kids when I had to do my long runs. And so maybe as we're talking right now, Jonathan, we're talking about ways to actually overcome the problems we just talked about in our first discussion. How do you build a sense of community, love, purpose, and shared joys and shared tribulation that you overcome? That, I mean, anybody, you black, white, gay, Hispanic, Republican, transgender, anybody can enjoy the benefits of an ice bath or a marathon and overcoming something that's challenging. And maybe that's, or enjoying a good meal. Whoa, the flavors of that were incredible. Yeah, I never had plantains in my life with this kind of, you know, Jamaican stuff, right? Or whatever. So
let me speak to that real quick.
Yeah.
Let me speak to that real quick, because you just brought up a really good point. Is I don't think people can get to the capacity to enjoy things together, because that's the value of the meal. Like, my family was all about the meal, but you can't get to the point of the meal until there's trust. And I usually don't trust you because you potentially could hurt me. And that's sort of the general malaise keeping people apart. We've got to find a way to help people get back to the center rather than being so polarized. It's the polarity that's keeping us from the dialogue that happens in the middle. And I think that's the problem that we've got to solve. And I like the way he, you know, you and I got on really extensive biohacking over the last year and a half. And what has been your overall experience of it?
So a few things. I would say that consistency is more important than high intensity. So working out moderately 3 to 4 times a week is better than working out once really intensely, right? I think having the consistency is key. Learning things about limiting caloric intake and having those 12, 14-hour windows of not eating, which helps slough off dead cells, right? We've learned physiologically that when the body is deprived of a source of nutrition and calories, it goes into a state of looking at the cells in the body and becoming very efficient at getting rid of the ones that are actually bringing us down, right? So I would say, like, that was a huge aspect. And the third thing is, you know, And when we go through T-SPAN, they talk about getting sun. Like, there's a daily journal, right? Did you get enough sleep? Did you get 20 minutes of sun? Did you get in your exercise? Mm-hmm. You know, what's your attitude like? And, you know, did you get your meditation in, right? So these are things that are very holistic. And when you can actually bring them all together, this is where I think, and this is where I think people are legit. It's kind of common sense, but at the same time, it's still hard for people to overcome. We follow, you've heard of Carnivore Aurelius. He's been on Joe Rogan and he's the carnivore diet guy, right? I mean, he's talking about grounding. Oh, we talk about grounding too, right? Mm-hmm. Grounding. And these things are like so basic, and it's almost as if we just go back in time to the early days when we were out there, you know, changing this, the face of the United States, right? We were hunting, right? We were chopping wood. You're making things with your own hands. Even people talk about when you're making and cutting your own vegetables. These are all part of that symbiotic relationship. And if we go back to the basics instead of processed things and fake artificial things, blue light from Dr. Cruz, I think we can actually overcome a variety of ills, the ills that we talk about of depression, anxiety. Now, we know bipolar, that's almost impossible to alleviate outside of medication. There's just something so broken there, right? That if people get off their meds, they just, it's really bad. But are there parts of anxiety and depression that if you did spend your time having a good diet, good quality community time with people who love and share interests, diet, exercise, you know, sun, these things, and meditation, could we alleviate a lot of this stuff? And is this another reason why we are somewhat us versus them in terms of big pharma? And you look at the kinds of things, every single time somebody starts bagging on some other thing, they come up with something new like Ozempic, right? So that's what I've learned this over this season.
You know, what's interesting is I've done I got a grounding sheet.
Right.
I extensively feel like I'm sleeping better consistently.
Your wife was okay with it. I bought mine, and my wife says no. I'm not.
No, she was totally. We put it under a normal sheet, so it's the sheet.
Oh, you do put it under. Okay.
Yeah, we put it under the sheet, but that still works.
It still works. Okay. I was told that it likes it. If you like it, that you should have contact with it. So if you're telling me it has effectiveness underneath the sheet, then that might be a good fit.
Yes, for me.
Good.
I've done fasting. Fasting to me has been the most beneficial thing I've probably ever done for my health. I simply reduced the quantity of food and I basically lost 30 pounds of basic fat.
That's right.
Yep. And that was profound, and I've kept it off. I eat two times a day, and on weekends I have dessert. And I may have more than that, but typically on the weekends, I'm pretty good during the week and I've been able to maintain my weight. So that's been hands down the most beneficial. I was doing sun gazing every morning for 5 minutes with my eyes closed, but it worked wonderfully. And I've noticed I've been out of that habit, and I feel like my body misses it. It's weird. It's like my body keeps like, dude, go outside for 5 minutes, you know? And it's a wild process that happened to me of just my body started craving sunlight. It was wonderful.
I saw a patch of sunlight one day, and I'm like, I got to go get that. And like Dr. Cruz, I've seen a Twitter picture of him. You've got this line of sunlight, even though it's through a window, and all the mammals. You got three dogs and two cats lined up only in the sun, right? And they're like, they get it, right?
I know. So
watching a dog just kick it in the sun for like hours. Like, dude, a dog's life, man. Look at this dog.
My dog likes to lay on his back and his stomach to the sun. Totally.
Hey, he's tanning the perineum. Don't forget, yes, that's supposed to be important too in the balls, right? If you got him.
So I bought a cold bath and I have not used it yet. Part of that is because it's like 110 degrees here in the summer. So it's hard to do anything in the summer. And in the cold, it's hard to start in the cold. I've bailed on that one. I have not been successful. I haven't bailed on it. I just haven't gotten to it. I'm still going to get to it because I have it. I dramatically reduced my alcohol intake. I think that was another thing that I'm comfortable with two drinks on the weekend. I don't need to. I'm totally comfortable with it. That was actually pretty easy. The thing that changed and I think the thing that I think had the most impact was really the idea of switching my brain from this won't work to this will work. And that's the idea of manifesting. I think that's really the core of manifesting, is this idea of switching your brain from the negative to the positive potential. Because when your brain is operating on the positive potential, you're always believing in yourself and believing that it can happen. And you're looking for the signs of serendipity, because we need serendipity along the way. We need the breadcrumbs. If you're not looking for the breadcrumbs, you're not going to see them, and you're not going to have the motivation, the recurrence to keep going when it gets really hard, unless you've developed a maturity to keep going. Because if you don't have resilience developed, like I'm trying to teach my kids right now how to develop resilience, and it's hard because it requires suffering to learn. It's the hardest thing. And we want to go, oh shit, that sucks. But in staying in that, that's where we learn what we're capable of to be able to handle it. And then we can let the negative energy hit us, but not deeply affect us. Cause that's all we have to do, is let go of the negative energy. And I think that's that shift in my brain from, I'm, instead of assuming this won't work in my life, I'm going to assume it will. And I think it has dramatically impacted me, that shift in my brain. I can.
What about microdosing?
That's another one. That has had a profound effect on me. I have yet to have a really, I don't want to say that. That's not true. It has made me a much freer person with the world around. I wasn't on anything last night, but when I was in, last night I was at Oracle, or at the Chase Center in San Francisco, to see Gonzaga play San Francisco. And I had this is a moment of elevation of like, what would it feel like? Like that shifting of brain. I sat there and every single person around me was laughing and smiling at the exact same time.
Wow.
And it was weird. I mean, like, I'm not talking about like 5 or 10 people. I'm talking about hundreds of people, because Gonzaga was playing out of their mind and everybody was into it. And I just looked
around. Are they making a run? Are they making a run for March Madness?
They're trying. They're not. This is probably the weakest team they've had in 20 years.
Okay.
They're young. They don't have a core player defined yet that is elevated. They don't have that player this year. Anyways, as I'm seeing that and I had this flash, it was like, is it possible for a humanity to go through a Me Too movement that shifts them in a way that we stop that polarity and start loving our neighbor? It's that simple, just to that nth degree of just loving the person next to you. And it felt in that moment, I had this very deep sense of experiential feeling of, this is what unity feels like. Mm. It was wild. It was one of the more wild experiences I've ever had in my life. And it only lasted for about 4 seconds, but it was this vision of unity where humanity can elevate to a point where it stops fighting so much, because that's the polarities, and says, oh, guess what? The more valuable place to be in is here in the center. You know, that's what our parents' generation was trying to get to after World War II, is to this place where we're
on the same page. We're all going to get out of this war, roll up our boots and our sleeves. We're going to work hard. You didn't see the kind of welfare state. Everybody was just gunning for getting better. And
for
even
even
the 60s, African-American community, there was a lot of, especially the married ones with kids, tended to do much better. And then something happened. I don't know if it was after Lyndon Johnson or not, but things changed dramatically. But and our bodies too. So, I mean, if you look back in the 40s and 50s and the 30s and 40s and 50s about how people looked in their suits, everybody was thin, lithe. Right. All this stuff was going on. So to
that point, one of the things that I've recognized is, in my youth, racism was extensive, like extensive. And although we've dealt with it, I don't feel like we've had a moment. That's the one issue that I think would go the farthest, is this idea of, what if we could have a moment of reconciliation collectively between blacks and whites, or whites and people of color, I think is, because whites are this group that is, their backs are against the wall, and there's got to be that moment of peace, because that's how Paulo Freire talked about it, is that the, when the oppressed rise up and discover their value, they don't gain their value back by killing the oppressor.
Mm-hmm.
They gain it back by lifting the oppressor up and forgiving them and saying, okay, let's move together collectively forward. And realistically, can there be this moment where we can extensively deal with this collective problem of racism in our history and say, visually to the people, is this is a moment of reconciliation? And whites saying, yeah, that is our lineage. Let's move forward. Can we find forgiveness and reconciliation? That's what I think. And the reason why I brought that up is I'm in the process right now of looking at developing a documentary with that idea, because I think that is one of the biggest potentials for radical change in our communities.
TRC as well. Are you going to tie into Mandela and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa as well? Very similar kinds of constructs, right?
Yes.
I guess the question is, how do you perpetuate it? Because it seems to me that even though they made great strides.
That's a really important point, but let me speak to it, because I thought about that. It's the perpetuation problem is the second problem to solve. The first is we need a landmark moment like a Declaration of Independence or some landmark movement, like a Million Man March thing that says collectively we are starting this process. And I think that's the first thing that needs to happen. But that is an important question to answer. How do you sustain that movement? Because there'll be backlash, but
they're falling apart in South Africa today. Yeah.
Do you remember when Obama got elected?
Unfortunately, yes.
I know you're not a fan of Obama. I totally get it. But racially, that is one of the most defining moments in African American history ever. Because this was a black man rising to that level to say, okay, we broke through and we're now part of the process. That was a huge moment. And that's a type of level of event I would love to see happen. That is something that is landmark, that is collectively, people were weeping because for the first time they could see the glass ceiling had been broken. That's all I'm thinking of is how do you create those moments, like what Nate is trying to do, those moments in communities that are landmark moments. So,
yeah.
All right, let's go to the next one.
What do we got next?
So all the stuff in our reality is made up of things that are almost all nothing, no thing. And now as a result, they're looking at the physical part of the atom. They're seeing that those things, which we thought were solid, are made up of smaller things that aren't actually solid at all. They're only solid sometimes. They have a potential of being solid. And so we live in this distorted reality where we think that everything is physical around us, but it's not. It's all energy. We've been given these five senses, these energetic vibrational interpretation devices that simulate a physical reality, which is our bodysuit, right? That can hear things as if it's really there. But you're not really hearing words that I'm speaking. Your tympanic membrane is interpreting very specific vibration and energy that I'm speaking from a mouth that doesn't even really exist and translating it into this conversation. Like, if you're not wowed, then I don't know if you're alive.
All right, what do you think, man?
He's right. I mean, you look at a chair and the chair, and you can sit in the chair. And if you really open what that is up, you see that it's actually just a bunch of tightly knit molecules, right? It's the nature of the wood that brings together.
For definition for our audience, let's give the audience what he means by the part that doesn't exist. It's 99.99999% is empty.
Nothing. Yeah.
There's nothing. Okay. There's nothing there.
Yeah.
And now he's talking about the 0.0000001% that we think does now really doesn't. That's the I just clarified that.
Well, so I mean, to be fair, I mean, we always talk about. I mean, there are objects that can pass through a chair, right? There are objects that are so small, called a quark or a photon, that it's so small it could just pass through a chair, like it's going through like a big tree forest, right? Here's a big redwoods, and I'm just passing straight through it, and that's something we know ontologically true, physically true, physics in terms of metaphysics, right? But I guess the question I would have is, if it is mostly nothing or it could be potential, does that mean you could change it at will? Does that mean it could be changed? Does it mean the potentiality and the reality of it could be in the state of flux?
Okay, let me answer that question because I actually thought about this the other day. I was playing around with the idea of what if natural laws are simply things we've agreed to historically that our body has gotten used to over time. So if I smack my head on a rock, it's going to damage my brain, right? And so I put my hand up against the window because it was kind of an interesting thing. There was nothing, visually it looked like it was nothing in front of me, but I could feel the glass and I knew the glass was there, but I thought, what if the only thing stopping my hand going through this glass is my belief in the law that the glass is? Because it's just a construct. And my world includes the construct of that possibility. So how then did Jesus, I'm going to use Jesus as an example, heal? Because last night I saw a guy at Chase Center, and he was severely handicapped from drug use. Like and his whole leg, I think, had gout.
Was he a homeless person?
He was homeless. Yes.
Okay, yeah.
I'm sorry. He wasn't at Chase Center. He was at the Starbucks where I met my son for lunch. And I was going, how did Jesus just go say, I'm going to heal that? Like, that's what I want to be able to do. And that was the thing is it simply because I don't believe I can do it? That's the question I'm asking for myself right now is my limitations created by my own self-limitations to this narrative, this grand narrative, the matrix? When he got out of the matrix, he could bend a spoon or he contemplated. So that's the question I'm asking right now.
Yeah. He defied the law that he was pre-given, right?
Exactly.
The kid helped him understand that there was no spoon, right? And that's how he was able to bend it around, and then he got the gift later on.
Jesus disappeared through crowds. How did he do that? You know, like, Jesus is an easy one because it's one that most people understand or have heard the stories. Like, Jesus healed people. I wanted to heal this guy. I don't know why. He just caught my attention and I wanted to heal him. And I thought, man, why am I not? What is stopping me from being able to heal somebody?
It's pride. I had the same thing happen to me multiple times where I've seen somebody in a wheelchair and there's almost there's something tugging at you to walk up, right, lay hands on him or her, and mm-hmm. say, "I want you to get up out of this wheelchair," and risk the embarrassment and laughing stockness of the whole process when it doesn't happen. And that, in the back of our minds, we're thinking that I've had that feeling, right? You know, like, you're not always, you can see 100 people, but every now and then you've got that. And it's like, damn it. Is that the tug? Is that something that I should have acted on, right? In terms of, like, even a homeless person, right? You see 100, they're asking for money and they're coming up with cute little new signs. Hey, fuck it. Or like flipping it over and this is all positive and like, just give me a beer, right? I mean, sometimes it's really funny and sometimes it's just that. And there are times where you feel like there's eye contact and I should have probably given that guy something about that. It's not just the one in the masses, right? Because you can't do that every day, right? You can't just have a handful of ones and tens and fives and have that out all day. So is that what you think it might be? In my mind, that's what would be holding me back. I'm going to look like a fucking idiot.
It has to be. It's self-limitation, but I don't know what the limiters are.
Yeah.
Like, and the only thing I could agree to is that historically my body has always been trained. I can't break that construct. But what if it's simply the limitation my body has accepted throughout its history? Like, how many bodies has I have DNA from whoever was first. That's the reality. We all have DNA from the first person. And there's a split, but it's hundreds and thousands of bodies in between. or I don't know how many it is. I'd be curious to actually know that number. But there's a break and there's a learned process. Like I am my line's historical record of survival. Mm-hmm. That's what I am.
Fair enough.
Yeah. And so is it that survival requires agreeing to that construct? I don't know. Because Jesus transcended it. And Jesus has always been the best example of living that I've ever found. And he could heal. And he even said we could heal. And I that's the one thing that, like when my mom was dying, I wanted to be able to heal her. You know?
Of course.
She had congestive heart failure. And I wanted to be able to heal her. So that's the question that I'm kind of contemplating is that do I have the capacity and is it simply because that's the matrix? Because that's the rule of the matrix. And Neo was able to transcend the matrix.
I think that we talked about having somebody I used to know from church who was healed herself. And she's been doing a lot of ministry, very, very charismatic movement. She might mm-hmm. be great to have on board to help us make that next step and to share stories.
Have you ever met someone who's healed somebody? Or been
not,
healed?
Not individually. Not in the way we want to talk about, right? It always comes down to the withered hand, right? Here's a kid from mm-hmm. birth, congenital, withered hand, and this guy came up and healed that hand. That hand is now completely made whole, as what we've heard about in the Bible, right? Or the guy was born blind. And Jesus asks, you know, was it his fault or the sins of the father?
Well, it said scales fell from his eyes.
Yeah.
You know,
there's a couple different versions. There's one where he actually makes a mud and other times he just heals. But then there's one where he looks like there's spindly things, which people give physiological actual healing processes because that's what happens when people come out of a blind state and can heal again. But what we're getting at is, can we find something where, you know, this person was in a wheelchair, but they were just bound there for like 3 years and they just couldn't really do it? I mean, show me, you know, stage 4 cancer on Tuesday and show me that eradication on Wednesday by going to that faith healer in the same lung, right? Here's the x-ray. Here's the Mayo Clinic. Here is, what is it? What's his name? Joel Osteen's church in mm-hmm. Texas. Here's Joel Osteen's church. Here's waving. Here's up on stage. And we took an x-ray after he left the premises and it's gone, right? I think that, I mean, even look at me. I mean, I'm a believer, right? And I don't even call myself a cessationist. You know, cessationists believe that all of the healings that we've seen in the Bible were relegated to the first century as the apostles continued to grow and expand. And we see obviously Paul. Right?
Did you learn that from John MacArthur?
No, cessationism is something that a lot of conservative
people
believe it. Yeah, yeah. I didn't learn much from John MacArthur. Thank God.
Yeah. John MacArthur is a cessationist. So a very good friend of mine. Yeah. He's one of the strictest cessationists I've ever. For those who don't know, cessationism, what was it? You explained it. What was it?
Cessationism is the belief that all of the Holy Spirit gifts that were breathed upon the apostles at Pentecost and what Jesus promised them and what we actually saw in the book of Acts with Peter. Peter actually healed a woman named Tabitha or Dorcas. She was dead. And then Paul healed, rose somebody from the dead. He was falling asleep during one of Paul's sermons, falls out the window, drops down dead. And Paul heals him completely, brings him back from the dead, right? So we actually have resurrections. But Jesus did tell us greater things you will do than I did. And yet cessationists believe that after the apostles left and that first group were gone, it kind of ended. That was supposed to be the first.
Did it include all the gifts or just speaking in tongues? Because I thought it was speaking in tongues.
No, it would include one-on-one healings. So when we talk, I don't. John MacArthur would not deny the fact that if we've got the entire church, we had this happen to us at our church at Ventura Missionary. We were all. I was at a prayer group with my good mentor and friend. My wife was at a women's Bible study. We had a friend driving down to San Diego, and we hear that one of the amazing ladies of the church, her name was Janice, she was on her deathbed. Everybody's like, she's toast, right? Everybody mm-hmm. stop what you're doing and pray. And we all prayed. We prayed for a freaking hour, dude, prayed through the Psalms. It was incredible act of community work. My wife was praying. These guys stopped, pulled over by the side of the road and started praying. The attending nurse became a believer because she pulled out of it. She said, she was a dead woman walking. I am going to be, whatever you guys just did there, whatever this was all about, I want to be a part of this. And it was amazing. She was the nurse. And she says, whatever happened there was an absolute miracle. And we all took credit as a community. Now, what we're seeing today is individual people, Benny Hinn, or somebody, we're hearing people raising people from the dead in Africa and stuff. But what I'm getting at is, I think a lot of people are skeptical of still those one-on-one things. Like, God, heal me, right? And all of a sudden, I have this, you know, addiction to heroin, and, you know, God can do that. We can see God coming to people in dreams in the Middle East, and people who are Muslim are seeing Jesus and saying, I want to become a Christ follower now, right?
I've met a gentleman who brought someone back to life, and one of the most sincere people I've ever met. I worked at a Christian organization.
City team.
And he was basically their spokesman for a lot of their worldwide ministries. And he was extremely genuine, and he brought a man back who had been dead for 5 hours. So it wasn't, and it was documented. The entire town was there. He did it in front of a large group of people.
He redlined. The guy was like, was he on a monitor?
So he had been dead for 5 hours when my friend arrived in the village. It was kind of like,
it was a village. Okay. He wasn't hooked up to an EKG or a monitor. Okay.
Yeah. There was no monitor. He was dead on a table in a hut. That's what it was like. And the whole
town. There was no
more
breath in him. They're like, okay, there's nothing.
He had stopped. Yeah. He was cold.
Got it.
So full cold. So he had been in rigor mortis, and he came back to life. And it's hard to, like, I'm not against, the more that I study energy, the more that I realized how historically what Jesus and Paul and Peter were doing was a movement of energy. I can't remember what her name is, but she says all life is the manipulation of energy. Mm-hmm. And Jesus used it for positive, because you can use it for negative, but Jesus used it for positive. Peter healed someone for the positive reason for it.
Of course.
And I think that's partly why our bodies don't let us see it, is because we're not mature enough to handle that kind of responsibility. That would be I don't believe in I don't know about Benny Hinn. I've heard stories that he's very real in some respects, and I'm sure we've seen, it looks fantastical where it's almost silly, but at the same time, what if it's real? I mean, it's real to some extent. You can't manufacture a 30 to 40 year career out of fakery. That's just not possible.
He's come around. He's actually become a little bit less, when you've got all those people and he's like, there's a great song about "Let the Bodies Hit the Floor." I don't know if you ever heard.
Oh, that God, that's so funny! Bodies. I've seen that video.
And then he's like, and they're all just lurching and stuff.
Yeah.
But here's the other thing that I always try to get out of that: it's great to have these wonderful movements of elation and being slain in the spirit and stuff. But then, what do you go out and do with that, right? And it's the same thing about the reconciliation thing. It's about also that awesome feeling of everybody smiling and laughing, 100 people around you at the Gonzaga game. Mm-hmm. And you can't live in that forever, but it does give you a glimpse of what something like that could look like. And yet, how do you live in an area of, you're not in overdrive and not doing 180 miles an hour, but you're cruising along at 80 and everybody's working together and not having the same kind of speed bumps that we have all the time.
So here's my question. This is what got me, because right before I went in the game, I watched this video about elevating your life. Mm. And the concept is, Cleburne talked all about this, is that we're going to reach a point where we elevate. And is that elevation a moment? Because that's what was happening in that 4 seconds. It was almost like a foreshadowing of what Cleburne was talking about, was what if I wake up one day and the shift has happened? What would you do with that when you're already like the elevation process? What if it's going to dramatically knock you on your ass because it's going to be so good? I'm looking for the good, and I'm wondering if what that shift looks like, if it, you know, what he was talking about. I think that's probably one of the biggest biohacks that I've really taken on this year, is this idea that I am intimately source. I am. That's what Jesus said. I am. And I've taken on that idea now for almost a year. And I think it's that to me is probably the most profound link that has made the rest really, really good.
Yeah. I still differ with you on this, because when Jesus says I am, he's quoting I am that I am. It's John 8:58, and he is literally claiming divinity at that stage, right? So he's not just saying I am Cleburne or I am happy and I am positive.
At an energetic level.
Yeah, he's claiming divinity, and that's why they were going to try to kill him, because he could. Oh, who are you? You know Abraham? He goes, before Abraham was, I am.
Right.
Right?
He said,
are you saying you're greater than Father? And then that's when they're like, okay, this guy's an absolute blasphemer. And what I'm getting, one of the things that I was going to laugh about when you've talked about, like, I am God and I am fully God. I am part of that construct. I'm like, just. Give the audience just a little glimpse of what that moment of creation was like when you breathed life into the world, Jonathan. Just help me understand just that moment of revelation as you created.
Well, here's how
I want you to tell me what that experience was like. Just give me a little hint. So,
I started this idea on my walk with my dog. So that's where I really get into it consistently. I talk about this idea in my head with myself as I walk my dog. It's my meditation time. Mm-hmm. I'm creative. I shoot reels. I have thoughts. I take thousands of notes. And as I started seeing this possibility, at first it was a possibility of what if I am? Like, that was the first question. I thought, what if, can I logically be? And I answered that question and I sent you a text that night, because I said, if I can love, that means I am love, because I'm part of love. I have love to give. That means I'm connected to source. So all you have to be able to do to prove that you are connected to God or a part of God is that you are capable of loving. So to love, which is the greatest commandment, is simply a call to this idea that you are already connected. You are part of God, but you're the individual expression of God on earth. And there's millions of those. So at a subatomic level, you're all one. But your individual expressions that are radically mentally disturbed through thousands of years of history saying you suck. And we are reaching a point where we're waking up to the reality that we don't suck. That's the epoch that I think is happening. And I think people are waking up. Like, I'm Jonathan in this body.
But we're not doing it from our own divinity. We're doing it from something extant. Neo, and this is the argument that I've been making, Neo knew something was driving him, and it wasn't him.
Jonathan,
it was extant. It was
not Jonathan him. Jonathan is this world's, my avatar.
Yeah.
But I remember, and this is a moment in my life that I've never forgotten. I remember the first day I could write my name Jonathan. Okay. Or I was Johnny when I was a kid. So I was writing Johnny. I was in my bed. It was 9 o'clock at night. I had been in bed for an hour. I was 4 or 5, and I learned it in kindergarten, I think. I pulled the cover out, I had a flashlight, and I wrote my name. I was so proud of that. But that's the moment I became an avatar. Before that, I had no consciousness of identity.
Yeah.
I didn't need one.
Your brain develops too, right? That's where you learn abstractions. You got to a point and kids, don't forget, there's a place in time where kids don't know anything other than themselves. They can't think in outside of themselves, right? They can't think in third party. There's a great story. I forgot it, but it's about the pirate and about, like, somebody would have actually hid something. And, like, why would you have thought that, right? Like, you're only seeing what's observable to you instead of thinking what somebody else might have done to change that situation, right?
Well, I'm seeing that right now with my grandson, Kaysen. He's not capable of seeing himself separate from his mom. So when his mom...
Correct.
Goes into the garage for a second. He freaks out because he doesn't know where he is. Mm-hmm. That's what he's experiencing. And because he only sees his mom as himself. That's because they're one and the same. And I think what's happened is by taking on that, first I took on the possibility, then I took on the opportunity and says, let's try this idea out. What is the cost? And I was very careful going into that saying, I'm going to listen to the results very clearly. And by seeing myself as source and connected to God, I am, it, I think, solves the problem in the Garden of Eden, which is the, am I good or evil? I am a collective representation of both as an expression in the world, living that out. But there's full grace. That's what the cross did. The cross established grace was already true. It's always been true since the garden. Everything was good. And living into that reality that I am fully connected. And then I think this is the birth of an age where we are going to see the fullest expression. That's how God works. God always comes in the end.
We've had 2,000 year increments, sounds like, because why did God choose 2,000 years ago to come in and finally say, here's the evidence of the cross, right? Or he took the Roman Empire, he took a terrible kind of thing, he took a potential scripture from Isaiah, talks about he'll be pierced for our transgressions, like nailed to the cross. So, I mean, we always wonder about those things. The law was given hundreds of years beforehand.
It's not perfect to the 2,000, but it took 2,500 years for the original law, for the Ten Commandments to show up. Hammurabi's law had been there. So I think you're 2,000 years. But to that point, it's taken us 2,000 years to really acknowledge that grace is true. The church is waking up to, okay, grace is true. We got to get over ourselves. And it's embracing that. Like when I was a kid, grace was there, but hey, stay away from it, because
there was a caveat to the grace.
You didn't want to give license. Everybody was worried about license. And here's the reality. There is license. Hitler is in heaven, people. He is. He's there. And it's not that he, because here's the reality.
I thought he has to go through eons of tribulation.
But he's there. Because there is no time.
That's
true. So he's there. It's a representation. It's an avatar like me of possibility. That's all Hitler is. He's a representation of possibility of the human idea in this narrative we call life, the matrix. And he's going to be there. So the question is not, how do I get him out of heaven, but how do I learn to deal with him being there? And you can only do that through love.
Yeah.
You can only do that through love.
Mao's not
because
there.
Love,
he killed 80 million people. Mao's not going to make it, dude. He's toast.
I know. And that's the hard part of the kingdom of God, is that it includes the criminal. It did. Jesus was crucified with two criminals to his left and right. And that is the one I think burns people the most. But we never, because if you and I are both the God image at a subatomic level, we're both avatars having different expressions of the same idea. I don't want to kill you because you're me. And that's what I think that's what mindfulness is waking us up to. That I think the world is, and I think Gen Z is halfway there, that they're tired of fighting against each other, but they don't know how to love each other. The polarization is only possible when you lose the concept of love. And that's why the evangelical church, which was the voice box for most of America, took us in a wrong path. It got away from love and went to politics. And that is what
there is a progress. So they've moved from wanting to kill each other to not wanting to kill each other. They're too tired of that. And they're too beat up from all the bullshit. Now they just need to learn to love. There's still a ton of us older folks that are still willing to bring up arms. We're still at the level of fighting.
Well, also I want to say, in terms of love, I'm not saying love just means, oh, let's have a woo-woo, ooey-gooey experience where we just deal with our people. It's not. Love is the judgment of good. It's saying, Rich, you are good, so I'm not going to kill you. Okay? And in that space, we deal with those people who break that law. That's the only law there is the law of love. That's it. There's no other laws. We create laws, but the only law that exists in the universe is the law of love that says, you are good. You're here. Guess what? The first law of thermodynamics is, you're here. Now you got to deal with it. So that's consciousness. And if we don't wake up to removing those conflicts, but I think this is God's story anyway, so we're just participants in it. And that's the mystery of it, is, as Alan Watts said, we're going to wake up and go, oh, that was a cool dream.
Totally.
That's my one big trump card is that I think Alan Watts got it right. So we're going to wake up realizing we are God who has played a trick on ourselves so we could have a good laugh.
Yep.
So
that's a good way to finish. How can you beat that?
To all of our listeners, please subscribe, review, let us know who you'd like to hear. If you have someone you'd like to introduce to us to be on the show, please do. You can go to livinginthematrix.ai. And we are Living Matrix Podcast on Instagram. Would love to have you follow. This has been one of my, I love these. These were the original conversations we've had for the last 15 years of just talking stuff and having these wild ass conversations. So I love that, Rich. It's been awesome. To all of our listeners, have a wonderful week, and we will talk to you soon. Much love, everybody.